Welcome to a brand new deep dive. You know, when you sit down to watch a sci-fi movie, the quantum stuff always just looks like magic.
Oh, absolutely. It's like the ultimate narrative cheat code.
Right. Someone presses a glowing blue button and suddenly they're traveling through time or, you know, hopping across multiverses or faxing their physical body across the galaxy.
Yeah.
It's cinematic, it's flawless, and it happens in the blink of an eye.
Yeah, whenever screenwriters write themselves into a corner, they just slap the word quantum in front of a noun and boom, the laws of physics are conveniently suspended.
Exactly. But then you look at reality. You open up a tech journal or the morning news to see what's actually happening, and the updates about quantum computing are entirely different.
They're a lot messier.
Yeah, you're reading about, like, catastrophic error rates, microscopic heat vibrations, and these massive tangled chandeliers of wire sitting inside giant refrigerators that are cooled with rare helium isotopes.
It's quite the visual contrast.
It is. And that massive disconnect between the glowing blue button and the freezing, gritty reality is what Praxeotech's highly anticipated new book calls The Popcorn Paradox. The book is called Quantum Computing in 2026, a real-world guide to qubits, code, and the coming quantum economy.
Popcorn paradox is just a brilliant term for it. And curing that paradox is really our mission for this deep dive today.
Right. We are functioning as a tech book review today, and we are not getting bogged down in heavy math.
No, definitely not. The goal is to bridge the gap between that sci-fi hype and the actual machines being built in corporate labs today. And honestly, the best part is that understanding this doesn't require a PhD in physics.
Yeah, the author points that out right in the introduction, right?
Yeah.
They say the real obstacle to understanding quantum computing isn't your intelligence, it's your posture.
Yes, posture.
What do they mean by posture, exactly?
Well, think about how you interact with technology every day. You are a consumer. You learn the interface on your smartphone, you tap the glass, and you just sort of assume the invisible machinery underneath is someone else's problem.
Right. I don't need to know how the battery chemistry works to, you know, send a text message.
Exactly. But quantum computing refuses that arrangement. It demands that you step just close enough to the machine to actually see the gears turning.
Okay.
And when you do, you realize something profoundly mind-bending, which is that the universe doesn't operate like a standard laptop. The universe has been computing in a quantum way all along.
Wow.
We are just finally learning how to build a machine that speaks its native language.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because to understand why we even need to speak a new language, we really have to look at the physical limits of the devices we already have.
Right.
We've been shrinking computer chips for decades, following Moore's Law, making everything faster and cheaper. But we are slamming into a physical wall right now, aren't we?
We are hitting a fundamental limit of nature. I mean, classical computers are built on binary logic. They use transistors, which are basically just microscopic switches turning current on and off to represent ones and zeros.
Just simple logic gates.
Exactly. And for the last 50 years, the engineering strategy was simple. Just make those switches smaller so you can pack billions of them onto a single silicon chip. But today, those transistors are getting microscopically small.
Like how small?
We are talking about features that are only a few atoms wide.
That is insane.
It is. And at the scale of individual atoms, the laws of classical physics completely break down.
Because the electrons don't act like physical objects anymore.
Right. They stop behaving like solid little billiard balls that you can just block with a wall, and they start acting like waves. When a transistor is only a few atoms thick, an electron can literally tunnel right through the physical barrier that's supposed to be keeping it in the off position.
Which means your switch is leaking. It's randomly turning on when it should be off. That sounds like a catastrophic bug for a traditional computer.
It totally destroys the deterministic logic a classical computer relies on. But here's the pivot in a quantum computer. That bizarre wave-like behavior isn't a bug.
It's a feature.
It becomes the foundational feature. Instead of trying to force subatomic particles to behave like classical switches, we harness their weirdness. And this brings us to the core building block of this entire field, the qubit, or quantum bit.
The book uses a really great visual for this, the globe analogy. So if a classical bit is like a coin lying flat on a table, you know, it's definitely heads, which is a one, or it's tails. A zero, a qubit isn't flat. A qubit is the entire globe.
That is a very helpful way to visualize it. If your qubit is the globe, it can be at the North Pole, representing a zero. Or it can be at the South Pole, representing a one.
Okay.
But it can also exist anywhere on the equator or anywhere else on the surface of that sphere. This is a state of superposition.
Superposition, right.
It's a complex mathematical blend of both states at the same time. As long as it remains isolated and unobserved, that single qubit is holding multiple potential realities simultaneously.
Wait, I'm struggling with this a bit. Let's ground this in a real problem. If I have a computer holding all these possibilities at once, how does that actually help me find an answer faster?
Good question.
Because there's an analogy in the book about a dark library that I really want to explore here. Imagine you are standing in a giant, pitch-black library. Millions of books are scattered randomly on the floor, and you need to find one specific title.
Okay, setting the scene.
Yeah. If you are using a classical computer, you are essentially a person walking around with a flashlight. You walk up to one book, shine your light on the cover, read the title, and if it's not the one you want, you walk to the next one.
Right.
It works. But checking millions of books one by one takes an agonizing amount of time.
Because it's a linear step-by-step process. I mean, even if you get a faster processor, you know, a faster person with a flashlight, you're still fundamentally checking them sequentially.
Right. So if the quantum computer isn't just a faster person with a flashlight, what is it actually doing in that dark library?
It acts more like a bat using a highly advanced form of sonar.
A bat. Okay.
When the quantum computer initiates a search, it doesn't walk to a single book. It sends out a single probability wave that washes over every single book in that pitch black room simultaneously.
Wow.
It explores the entire landscape of possibilities at once. And by listening to how that wave reflects and interacts with itself, it can locate the exact pattern it needs.
But wait, if it pings everything at once, shouldn't it just spit out a million wrong answers along with the right one?
You would think so, yeah.
Because if it reads every book simultaneously and you ask for the output, wouldn't you just get massive, unintelligible static?
What's fascinating here is that you've just identified the biggest myth in quantum computing.
Really?
Yes. People assume the machine tries all answers at once and just magically selects the right one. If a machine literally just tried every answer at once, the output would absolutely be random garbage.
Okay.
It would be like trying to listen to every radio station in the world at the exact same volume.
You wouldn't hear the song you were looking for at all.
Exactly. The secret engine of quantum computing isn't just superposition. It's a phenomenon called interference.
Interference.
You have to think of a quantum algorithm not as a simple math formula, but as a master choir director.
Oh, choir director.
Yeah, this director is manipulating the probability waves of all these qubits. Think of waves in a pool of water. When the peak of one wave meets the trough of another wave, they cancel each other out. That's destructive interference.
Right.
But when two peaks meet, they combine into a much larger wave. That's constructive interference.
Oh, I see. So the algorithm is essentially choreographing the calculation.
Mm-hmm.
It designs the sonar ping in such a way that all the wrong answers crash into each other and cancel out to zero.
Yes.
While the correct answers harmonize and get louder and louder.
Yeah.
So you don't get a random result. You get the amplified harmony.
Precisely.
Yeah.
You engineer the probability so that by the end of the calculation, the only state left standing is the correct answer.
That is brilliant.
It is. But and this is the author calls this fragility decoherence. The moment anything from the outside physical world interacts with this quantum system, the superposition collapses instantly.
The author compares it to building a magnificent towering castle out of mist on a windy day using only tweezers.
It's very poetic.
It is very poetic, but what does that actually mean in a physical lab? Like, what is the wind that's blowing the mist away?
Literally, a single particle of heat, a phonon bumping into your chip, acts like a wrecking ball to that mist.
Just one particle of heat.
Just one. Or a slight fluctuation in the Earth's magnetic field. Or a microscopic vibration from a truck driving down the street outside the lab.
You're kidding.
No, even a cosmic ray from a distant supernova passing through the atmosphere and hitting the processor. If any of that unauthorized energy touches the qubit, the choir stops singing, the waves crash, and your complex globe collapses back into a flat, useless coin.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because there's a massive paradox baked right into this fragility. It's the paradox of measurement.
Ah, yes.
If looking at the qubit, or bouncing even a single particle of light off it, destroys that delicate mist castle of information, how do we ever actually get our answer out of the machine?
Right. If we connect this to the bigger picture of how classical coding works, you have to realize that measurement in the quantum world is the finish line. It's not a checkpoint.
What do you mean by checkpoint?
Well, in classical computing, a developer can pause a program halfway through, look at the memory, check their work, debug it, and then resume. Observation is free. It doesn't change the data.
Oh, sure.
In quantum computing, observation is fatal.
So the lights have to stay completely off in that dark library.
Yes. The entire calculation, the entanglement, the probability choreographing, that sonar ping washing over everything, all of it must happen in total terrifying isolation.
Wow.
The algorithm is designed for exactly one look at exactly the right fraction of a millisecond. You keep the qubits dancing in the dark until the calculation is entirely finished, and when you finally measure them, you intentionally collapse the wave function, forcing it to reveal your final answer.
Which just sounds like an engineering nightmare. I mean, if the mist castle blows away when someone sneezes a mile away, how do you even put it in a box?
It's the ultimate challenge.
And because fighting this decoherence is so monumentally difficult, nobody in the industry actually agrees on what a quantum computer should physically look like.
No, they don't.
If you buy a classical laptop today, there's a standard silicon chip inside. But the book details how, in 2026, we are dead in the center of the hardware wars.
Walk into a quantum lab today, and you are stepping into a zoo of completely different machines. There are five distinct tribes competing right now, and each one is betting on a completely different physical object to act as their qubit.
Okay, let's look at how they're trying to solve this. First, you have the superconductors, and they are led by tech giants like IBM and Google.
Right. The superconducting approach uses those massive golden chandelier-like dilution refrigerators you see in the photos.
Yeah, they look like sci-fi props.
They do. They create artificial atoms out of superconducting metal, and to prevent heat vibrations from causing decoherence, they have to cool these chips down using rare helium-3 to a fraction of a degree above absolute zero.
That's incredibly cold.
We are talking about an environment colder than the vacuum of deep space. Now, these machines are incredibly fast, executing gates in nanoseconds, but they are incredibly prone to errors because those artificial atoms are just so sensitive.
Is freezing the only way to isolate a qubit? Because that seems really hard to scale.
It's definitely not the only way. You have the trapped ion tribe, which is championed by companies like IonQ.
And what do they do?
Instead of building a fragile artificial atom on a chip, they use perfect natural atoms, specifically rare earth ions. They strip off an electron to give the atom a charge, and then they trap it in a magnetic field in a vacuum chamber, just hovering in midair.
That sounds like actual levitation.
It basically is. And they manipulate these hovering atoms with astonishingly precise lasers. It's much slower than superconducting chips, but the fidelity is incredibly high. I mean, nature already manufactures perfect atoms, right? This tribe just figures out how to talk to them.
And then there's photonics, led by startups like Sequantum, who are taking a completely different route entirely.
Yeah, they don't use matter at all.
These particles of light, right? Photons.
Exactly. They send these photons racing through a microscopic maze of mirrors and splitters on a silicon chip. The massive advantage here is that photons don't interact with the environment very easily, so they don't need to be frozen to absolute zero. They can run at room temperature.
It reminds me so much of the early days of aviation.
Ah, that's a good comparison.
Right. Everyone is trying to achieve flight, but some are using biplanes, some are using rigid blimps, and some are just trying to strap rockets to chairs. And the material demands are just staggering.
They really are.
Like, I read the part about the silicon skin qubit tribe, and the book mentions they need silicon that is 99.99984% pure isotope 28.
Yes.
The author points out that this refinement process is closer to uranium enrichment than standard computer chip manufacturing. Why is it so extreme? Like, why isn't regular silicon good enough?
This perfectly illustrates that fight against decoherence we were talking about. Natural silicon, the kind we use to make normal computer chips, contains a mix of isotopes, including silicon 29.
Okay.
Silicon 29 has an extra neutron, which gives its nucleus a tiny magnetic spin. Now, to a classical computer, that tiny magnetic field doesn't matter at all.
Just background noise, yeah.
Exactly. But to a delicate quantum system, that stray magnetic spin acts like a localized wrecking ball. It scrambles the probability waves. So to build a reliable quantum chip, you have to surgically remove almost every single atom of silicon 29 from the material before you even begin manufacturing.
Wow. So with all these completely different approaches, will there be one winner to rule them all? Like VHS beating Betamax, or are we heading toward a different kind of future?
This raises a really important question for the industry, and the consensus in 2026 is pointing heavily toward a hybrid ecosystem.
So they'll work together.
Right. There likely won't be one universal best machine, just the best machine for a specific type of problem. You might send a fast optimization problem to a superconducting machine in the cloud, but then route a complex chemistry simulation to a trapped ion machine because it requires a lower error rate.
And speaking of chemistry, regardless of which hardware tribe wins, these massive, freezing, complicated machines are already starting to do real work. We've officially moved past theoretical math tricks.
We have.
Because for a long time, the goal was quantum supremacy. Google famously claimed that in 2019, with their Sycamore chip, solving a highly specific math problem faster than a supercomputer. But as the book points out, it was a completely useless math problem.
Yeah, it didn't solve a real-world business need. It was a vital proof of concept, absolutely. But yes, it lacked utility.
Right.
But the book argues that in 2025, the field quietly crossed the threshold into quantum utility. This means these machines are now solving actual narrow industry problems more efficiently or accurately than classical supercomputers can.
That's a huge milestone.
It is. And the most native application for this, the place where quantum computing absolutely sings, is chemistry and drug discovery.
Why is a classical supercomputer so bad at simulating a molecule?
Well, think about what a molecule actually is. It's not a collection of solid binary ones and zeros. A molecule is a complex, entangled quantum system of electron clouds, repulsive forces, and probabilities.
It's wavy.
Yes. If a classical computer tries to simulate a molecule, it has to calculate every single electron's repulsion against every other electron. For a molecule like caffeine, the complexity scales exponentially until even the biggest supercomputer on Earth simply runs out of memory.
Just for caffeine?
Just for caffeine. A classical computer struggles because it's speaking the wrong language. But a quantum computer maps those electron orbitals directly onto its qubits. It speaks the language of nature natively.
The book details a specific algorithm for this called the VQE. Okay, variational quantum eigensolver. Sounds like something a Marvel villain uses to destroy the timeline.
It really does.
Strip the jargon away from me. What is this actually doing?
It's essentially a hybrid loop, pairing a classical computer with a quantum computer to map the energy states of a molecule. The classical computer acts as the coach. It sets up the parameters, guesses an initial configuration, and hands the extremely heavy mathematical lifting to the quantum processor, which acts as the muscle.
So the quantum chip evaluates that complex energy landscape, hands the result back to the coach, and they just loop back and forth.
Exactly. They keep iterating, walking step by step down the energy landscape until they find the molecule's true lowest energy state. And we are already seeing this in action.
Oh, really?
Yes. The book highlights Moderna using an IBM machine to map the behavior of mRNA strands, and AstraZeneca using quantum accelerated tools to simulate complex catalytic reactions.
There's a visual from the book that really drove this home for me. Trying to model a complex drug molecule on a classical computer is like trying to build a beautiful, smooth sculpture out of Lego bricks.
That's a great way to put it.
Right. You can stack the blocks and get a rough, pixelated approximation of the shape, but you completely lose the smooth curve. The quantum chip doesn't have to simulate the curve. It is made of the same stuff as nature. It actually embodies the curve.
And that's a profound shift in how humanity approaches science. We aren't forcing reality into a digital approximation anymore. We are inviting reality to perform the calculation for us.
But if it can perfectly map a molecule's complexity, what else can it see through? Because this exact same ability to unravel complex, entangled pathways is completely terrifying for global cybersecurity.
Yes. It is the dark side of the quantum revolution. If we look back to 1994, a mathematician named Peter Shor proved that a stable, large-scale quantum computer could factor large prime numbers exponentially fast.
Give me an ELI 5 on prime factorization. Why do we care about large prime numbers?
It comes down to asymmetry. If I ask you to multiply 13 by 17, it's easy to calculate it's 221.
Okay.
But if I give you the number 221 and ask you to find the two prime numbers that multiply together to create it, that takes much longer.
Oh.
Now imagine that number isn't 3 digits long, but 600 digits long. Factoring it is so incredibly difficult that it forms a mathematical lock protecting almost all of our modern RSA encryption.
So everything.
Everything. Your credit card transactions, your private emails, state secrets, the global banking system. It all rests on the assumption that reverse engineering those prime factors would take a classical supercomputer millions of years.
Because it's trying every combination with a flashlight in the dark library.
Right. But Shor's algorithm uses quantum interference to find the prime factors in hours or even minutes. The lock shatters.
And even though that specific ultra-powerful quantum machine might be years away from being built, the threat is actually happening right now, today.
Yes. It's a strategy known as harvest now, decrypt later.
Which sounds ominous.
It is. Hackers and hostile nation-states are actively siphoning up massive amounts of heavily encrypted global data today. They can't read a word of it yet, but they are stockpiling it in massive data centers, simply waiting for the quantum machine of 2030 or 2035 to come online and unlock it all retrospectively.
Which brings us to a really fascinating equation in the book called Moskva's Theorem.
Moskva's Theorem is a stark warning. It says X plus Y must be less than Z.
Walk me through that.
X is the number of years your secret data needs to stay secure. Y is the number of years it will take to transition your entire massive IT infrastructure to new quantum-safe encryption.
Okay.
Those two numbers added together must be less than Z, the number of years, until a cryptographically relevant quantum computer is built. If X plus Y is greater than Z, your data is already effectively compromised.
And this is what is driving the urgent Y2Q migration years to quantum. Governments and banks are desperately updating the basic plumbing of the internet behind the scenes to post-quantum cryptography before Z arrives.
It's a massive race against time.
But it's not just security that's being disrupted. It's economics. The book details a concept called the infinite portfolio.
Yes. In global logistics and high finance, you are dealing with mind-numbing combinatorial complexity. Ford is currently using quantum algorithms to optimize their manufacturing logistics.
Really? Ford?
Yeah. And HSBC is using quantum machine learning for predicting bond order fills. They are doing this by treating financial risk not as a static flat number on a spreadsheet, but as a fluid wave function.
Wow.
They map economic uncertainty directly onto the physical qubits, allowing the machine to find the lowest energy state. In financial terms, that lowest energy state correlates to the most optimized, least risky path forward.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? Let's put the ultimate question to rest for the person listening to this right now. Is a quantum computer going to replace the classical laptop sitting on your desk or the smartphone in your pocket?
The short answer is absolutely not. As we've discussed, classical computers are phenomenally good at linear deterministic tasks. You don't need a quantum computer to stream a video, write an email, or balance your checkbook.
That makes sense.
Using a quantum computer for that would be wildly inefficient and incredibly expensive.
It would be like using a Formula One race car to go to the grocery store.
Exactly. Yeah. Or, as the book puts it, it would be like using an MRI machine as a stethoscope. An MRI is a miraculous piece of technology, but it's massive, expensive, and requires a room full of experts to keep it running. You don't throw away your stethoscope just because the MRI exists.
You use the right tool for the job.
Exactly. Quantum computing will act as an invisible, hyper-powerful co-processor accessed through the cloud. You will likely never own one, but your entire life, from the medicines you take to the batteries in your car to the security of your bank account, will be shaped by the discoveries it makes in the background.
This deep dive really synthesizes the fact that Praxiotech has perfectly positioned quantum computing, not just as a technology upgrade, but as an education in humility.
I love that takeaway.
Yeah, it teaches us that the universe allows for forms of order that totally defy our everyday, common sense, intuition things being in multiple states at once, or waves of probability canceling each other out, but that those weird forms of order can still be engineered.
It forces us to accept that the solid Newtonian world we see and touch is just the surface layer. The actual foundational engine of reality runs on probability and interference.
I want to leave you with one final totally mind-bending concept from the Edge of Imagination section of the book. We spent a lot of time talking about how quantum mechanics might predict the future, finding the most stable drug compound or the least risky financial portfolio.
Right.
But the book introduces the concept of retrodiction. In classical computing, when you use a logic gate, say in a D gate, information is lost. Two bits go in, one comes out, and the lost information is burned off as physical heat. You can't run a classical computer backward.
But quantum gates are completely different. They are perfectly reversible. Information is never destroyed. It's just transformed.
And because of that, we won't just use these machines to predict the future. We will eventually use them to reconstruct the past.
It's incredible to think about.
Imagine a chemist taking a mysterious final drug compound, encoding its exact molecular state into a quantum system, running an inverse quantum circuit, and perfectly rewinding reality to see exactly how that molecule was created, step by physical step.
It's a profound thought that fundamentally changes our relationship with time and information.
We've spent this entire deep dive talking about the popcorn paradox, that wide gap between the cinematic magic of a glowing blue time machine and the gritty reality of engineers working with tweezers in freezing labs trying to keep atoms from vibrating. But when you realize that these engineers are literally building machines that embody the actual fabric of nature, machines that could one day rewind chemical time, well, you realize the movie hasn't stopped. It's just playing out quietly in the background of our daily lives. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep your eyes open, because the quantum revolution is already here.